man who shot Liberty Valance, who shot Liberty Valance, is dead. Okay? His family, dead. Friends, severely injured. Facebook friends, mocked pretty mercilessly, I think. Favorite friend, Chandler Bing. I just think we share like a sort of a sardonic sense. It's not important. Listen, here's what is important. You shoot my co-host Corky McDonald in a dream, you better wake up and apologize. So, Corky, I am so sorry about shooting you in that dream. My God, what was that about? You weren't there. That was in my head. Okay. But let me properly introduce this man, because as his legend grows, as it supplants truth, even, we're just printing the legend, his introduction has to get longer and longer. He needs no introduction. We've established this man needs no introduction. Okay, he's mobbed on the streets. And yet the introductions. My God, the introductions. And I'll say to you right now, the co-host of this show, Cannon Fodder, my co-host, Corky McDonald, invented comedy. I hear what you're saying. Oh, Dan. And you say it just like that. Oh, Dan. Aristophanes invented comedy. Like, if you tell them you're the... Okay, yeah. Well, you're wrong. That's a popular theory on it, and I respect it. I really do. There's a lot of scholarly basis to this. I've read books... I just happen to disagree with that theory. I think comedy was invented the moment my co-host, Corky McDonald, put on his comedy shoes, strapped on his comedy sash, put his comedy belt loops through the comedy. He had his whole comedy out. He was outfitted in all comedy. He was comedy head to toe. This guy, all right, socks, shoes, all the way up to his hilarious Cat in the Hat hat, because this guy's funny, let me tell you. You know who it is. He needs no introduction, so this is all getting cut. It's Corky McDonald.
One of the greatest bits would be to do an introduction that never gets to the introducer.
It just never ends. I think I could do like a 45 to 50 minute introduction if needed. That was what, 2 minutes, 3 minutes maybe? I'm building.
It's pretty
to that
soon going to be 50-50 on the intro and movie coverage.
I won't even get to you. The show will just end like in the middle of the introduction. You'll never come alive. But man, are people going to get to know you? They're going to get to know the man. They're going to get to know the man behind the man.
Yeah.
In reality and in my dreams, and the dreams within the dreams, and people are skiing, they're shooting each other. Mm-hmm. It's all happening in slow motion.
So your dreams are Bond films or Bond openings anyway.
It's Inception is what it is. It's just, it's constantly, we go deeper and deeper and deeper, and it gets slower and slower and slower. Man, I mean, it's like this show... gets slower and slower and feels like it'll never end.
Okay, you know the intro's over, right? So I can actually start.
No, is it still happening? No, okay.
I think it's such a boring way to tell someone that they were in your dream just by saying, hey, I had a dream about you. You were captain of a ship or something. I think it's right. A better way to do it is be like, my subconscious thinks you're the key. My subconscious thinks you have a lot to reveal to me somehow. So spill it, pal. What is going on?
What are your secrets? I need to know.
Whatever it was that I needed explained to me or expressed, my subconscious thought you were the one to do it, pal.
No, I honestly never tell people about my dreams, and I hate it when people tell me about their dreams. It's the most annoying thing ever because it's never interesting. It can never be interesting. Because it never makes any fucking sense. And it's ironic because in movies, I love it when movies can replicate a dream or are surreal or are like dreamlike or, you know, in that kind of way. But it's just, never tell me about your dreams. My God, what a nightmare. What? Literally, nightmare.
Hey! Who said comedy was invented by Boopa Pippinies? That's not the, see? And that's a funny way to say his name. Folks,
this guy, he's just constantly
in all
constantly
ears.
It never he invented comedy, de-invented it, reinvented it, It's unbelievable what you're doing here.
Before we just drive this thing right into the smoking, smoldering
ground. It already happened.
We want to first tell you that we're going to be discussing the man who shot Liberty Valance today eventually.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that.
They don't forget.
But we want to thank our PayPal supporters. Seriously, all due reverence. All the irreverence is now pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. Due reverence. Yep. You guys are the lifeblood of the show. We couldn't do it without you. And we thank each and every one of you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I am fully reverent and actually fully revenant. As far as I'm concerned, you're a bear who is attacking and trying to murder.
100%.
So thank you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to maul me to death, nearly, by donating to the show, head to DearDaniel.com. Find the menu at the top of the page and click support the show. Any contribution helps keep this show going. Now that is the one really truly serious part of it. One is that we love our donors absolutely, and their contributions keep the show going. Everything in between that was nonsense, and Corky, you're gonna cut that, so thank you.
Now much like your Ransom Stoddards or your Jeans Pitney, we're gonna talk about the man who shot Liberty Valance. The IMDb synopsis: a senator returns to a western town for the funeral of an old friend and tells the story of his origins.
Yes, this week's film, it's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. It's directed by the great John Ford. Of course, we reviewed and canonized Ford's My Darling Clementine back in episode 46. Ford, best known as a maker of westerns, but he was also a maker of hits. The dude was a hit maker. He made popular films. He made award-winning films. He won 4 Oscars as best director. That's never been matched. And he made movies, for the most part, with big budgets and big stars. This cast is loaded. John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. First time they ever appeared together in a film, they would have one more together. But at this point in their careers, they were still A-listers, both of them. I mean, that's huge. Vera Miles also in the film, and then the supporting cast. Oh, my God. Lee Marvin, Edmund O'Brien, Strother Martin, Lee Van Cleef, and several members of what was known as Ford's stock company, Andy Devine, John Carradine, Woody Strode, John Quaylen, and more. Even though Ford by this time was better known as a maker of outdoor westerns, usually in color, he made this 1962 film in black and white and shot it on set. It was kind of like his Psycho, the way that like Hitchcock shot that film like a TV production after doing a lot of really big screen color films. It could be also that choice was part of deglamorizing and demythologizing the West, which is at the heart of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, this idea that our legends, these bedrock legends that our country and our culture are built on, are just stories, just good or convenient stories. And also maybe Ford is acknowledging his culpability in perpetuating those legends, as well as his own encroaching mortality, but kind of stripping it down to these basics. Still, others have said it was merely, you know, budget. It was Paramount was struggling at the time. They were cutting costs, and it could also be they shot it in black and white because Wayne and Stewart were both too old to be playing their roles. They were both in their 50s, and their characters, in the flashbacks at least, probably were in their 30s. According to the actors, it was a miserable, miserable shoot, mainly because Ford was just a complete fucking asshole throughout the entire production. I mean, the man's a genius, people, but genius and asshole often go hand in hand. John Wayne, his longtime collaborator and friend John Wayne, took the brunt of it. He was mocked and humiliated just mercilessly throughout the production. Stewart was spared until he made a comment Ford didn't like, and then it was his turn for public scorn. So everyone hated Ford. They all kind of took it out on each other, or they were kind of holding back a little bit. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Wayne's performance and really everyone in the film is so soulful, and Wayne just feels so unusually vulnerable, especially in that final stretch. Of course, Ford and Wayne, they turned it right around, made Donovan's Reef together the very next year. I mean, whatever, you know, it's like, whatever. Water's on the bridge, there's films to be made. Gene Pitney, of course, he sings the title song, written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. You want to talk about hit makers, my God. And it was a hit. It just wasn't used in the film. It's nowhere to be found in this entire movie. Imagine if, like, Will Smith did the Men in Black song, and they were like, eh, we're not going to put it in the film. It's just like, it wasn't just, I don't know, whatever. Released April 22nd, 1962, and it was a hit, the film. Reviews were mostly positive, although Variety and the monthly film Bolton hilariously suggested just cutting the last 20 minutes altogether, which is just like, what? How? Film was a huge influence on Sergio Leone. He says one of his biggest influence, and many other of the revisionist Western filmmakers. And today it's considered one of Ford's best, one of Wayne's best, and one of the great Westerns of all time, and one of the great films of all time, placed at number 108 in the most recent Sight and Sound Critics Poll of the best films ever made, one of three Ford films to make the list, along with The Searchers and My Darling Clementine. Corky.
Yeah.
We've already canonized Clementine. I thought we had done The Searchers, but that's not in there either. Clementine, you know, as I alluded, it's they're both unmistakably John Ford films, but Clementine is kind of majestic,
yeah,
in a way, right? It really is about myth making. It is a myth maker. It takes the Wyatt Earp legend and does whatever the heck it wants, you know, with it. As I said about the film, it's probably the most definitive and least factual of all of the Wyatt Earp films. This is something different. This is about myth making, and it's very stripped down. It's very bare. Did this one work for you like Clementine did?
One of the joys of getting to do this podcast with you is, for me, a first time visit to some films that, as I grew up, were always referenced, that I had always heard about and usually heard about spoken in really venerated terms, coming to them. And then those films meeting everything that was said about them. I'm thinking of like Singing in the Rain. Like, that was a great film, and it had always lived in my mind as a great film because of what it was said, but I had never seen it. I see it. It's like, yep, that's a fucking great film, right? Mm-hmm. The joy for me, especially with The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, a film that I had always long heard of as a great film and referenced, is that not only is a great film that I'm like, yep, great film, it's a subversive fucking film in a way that I wasn't expecting. I expected, and this is on me, Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne in Leeds. I grew up, you know, I was a child in the 80s. They were caricatures, like, and you kind of knew them from impressions and impersonations of them as opposed to their actual material. And I think even in some of their performances, they're caricatures of themselves. That's not what you get here. You get great performances throughout by everybody, but especially these two leads. It's a John Ford movie, and my Ford experience is nowhere near yours, but I know Ford of Monument Valley, epic, panoramic westerns. This is, looks like an episode of the Gunfighter, you know. Looks like it's doing nothing crazy, majestic or crazy awe inspiring, but it's very well told visually. It follows who it needs to follow to get you into shot. It's using light and shadows to great effect. So it's subversive, and then the story, and it's, I swear to God, like, the more I think about this movie, which you come to and you could be like, oh, this is just an incredibly light story of, you know, two rivals for a woman's affection and how they deal with a problem in the Old West. It's operating on such different levels, so many different levels. And every time you look at it, you see a new possibility. And I'm going to be kind of cheesy here and harken back to my whole like joke about dreams and subconscious. Was Ford doing this intentionally to bookend My Darling Clementine in this Monument Valley sweeping epic Western about a real event and real people, but make up the whole story and then close it, bookend it with this black and white shot on a studio stage with the biggest stars, and they're telling a made up story, but it's like we're telling the story of telling stories. It's like, did he do it on purpose? Well, did he do it because Paramount had no money? Did he even know he was doing it when he was doing it? But it just like had to be told that way. Fucking amazing, amazing, yeah. amazing movie on all levels.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, it like I tend to come down on the side that intent is often irrelevant. Like, what I'm getting out of it is what I'm getting out of it, whether you intended that or not. And I think that becomes even more true the further and further you get away from its original release and any thoughts about like budgets and audiences and things like that. It's who cares, right? Like, yeah. whatever the behind the scenes impetus for that kind of, we don't want to say it looks bad. As I just said, it's a very stunning visual film. It's just simpler and subtler. It doesn't look bad or cheap or anything like that. It's just like the production values have kind of been drawn down a bit. It's not a big epic. You wouldn't call this an epic film. It's a very intimate film. But whatever the reason for it, it does feel as though like he's stripping away the artifice. He's stripping away the mythology. And I think this is kind of like his ultimate statement. If it is, he's not a statement guy, you know, John Ford. He's the guy who says like, hey, I'm John Ford. I make Westerns. Yeah. Right? And it's like, you know, that's maybe a third of your filmography at most is Westerns. You know, he's from that sort of generation. He's not going to talk about his art. You know, he's not going to talk about what kind of auteur he is or anything like that. He's not a screed guy. He's not going to get on his soapbox. But I think that this film is in its kind of mystery. It is sort of like the ultimate statement that he has on the West, on myth making, on masculinity, both in a society and outside of society. Like, I think the film really kind of investigates, without naturally investigating it or interrogating it, like, what does it mean to be a man? Like, and especially what does it mean to be a man when you're a society that's transitioning from outlaw frontier to an actual society, to an actual like democratic society,
right.
that needs to have some kind of civility in order to survive. What kind of man is Liberty Valance, right? Like, this is like how in the outlaw society, this is how manliness is stacked up. The more violent you are, the less you care about people, the more of a man you are. But like, honestly, in our view, like, what kind of a man is he? Like, who needs to hurt people, who needs to humiliate people? You don't think of that as manly. What kind of man is Rance, the Jimmy Stewart character, who does not fight back except with a law book, right? That's not manly. But then what kind of man is Tom Donovan? This is the John Wayne character who could stand up to Valance. He's the only man in this town who could stand up to Valance and knows it and does nothing until he's directly affected, until we find out the twist at the end. But he is defined by wanting nothing except a life with Hallie, played by Vera Miles. Otherwise, unless you knock his stake down, literally knock his stake to the floor, he's not going to do anything. So, like, what kind of man is that? And I don't think Ford is there to, like, settle the question or necessarily even ask the question. But I do think it's there. It's kind of, you kind of chew on it and you leave just as confused about that question and the other questions.
Yeah.
Than when you started. You know, it ends on this really kind of interesting, ambiguous sort of note where you're like, is that what it is? Is this what our society is? Is this what the people are? Is this what our great men are?
Is this the good guy? Who was the good guy? Are there good
exactly.
guys?
Who's the good guy in all this? Exactly, right? And it's that's why it's so hilarious, these reviews at the time, these contemporaneous reviews from, like, you know, more of your kind of bottom line minded publications like Variety, who were like, just cut the last 20 minutes. Just cut it. Cut it. Cut it after Jimmy Stewart, you know, shoots Liberty Valance, and then end the movie. It was like, okay, because you thought it was like a nihilist dour vision. That's a nihilist dour vision, the movie just ending. Your message is murder is good. Like, and yeah. then also, like, why would Tom even be in the movie at that point, right? Like, what is his whole point in the film? But it also just ignores, again, like, what the movie's really about, which is, like, the creation of legends over the destruction of truth. And, like I said, this examination of masculinity and what makes a man.
I appreciated that this movie was talking about society, bringing society to a place like the West, how it's done.
Yeah.
And what makes you eligible to be that person compared to the people who actually get the stuff done? We know that Tom Donovan, you know, is the one who actually murders Liberty Valance, but yeah. It's framed as it's okay because it's Rance being the one who defended himself, quote unquote, against Liberty and killed him.
Yeah.
And that not only propels him, it's the most defining thing he does in his life and gets him mm-hmm. where he is. And as he says, go west, young man, seek fame and fortune. That's not what he says he's about. He says he's just about bringing law mm-hmm. and order and or rule, democracy. No, no, no. He kind of succumbs to the dark side, I would say,
yeah,
by becoming the state absolutely. Senator, adopting, you know, taking on the wife of a woman that he knows she still has a candle for Tom. She mm-hmm. may still love Rance, mm-hmm. but this is not, this would be more of a paint your wagon scenario where they share the wife as opposed to you're my wife only, you know, and you love me altruistically. I love what it was saying about all those things. I love that at the end, she goes and gets a desert bloom cactus because, mm. yeah, it's also that she misses Tom, misses that life, misses all of that. But when he sees it on the casket, that's like the death of the West. That's like the death of the yeah. Wild West.
Exactly.
Because, yeah. because of you, the guy looking at it, Rance, because of guys like you came here and taught people to read and taught us about democracy.
Yeah, right? Like you brought civilization, you brought law, you brought education, you brought civility and government and all the things that a society needs. But in doing that, you killed something.
You killed something.
Too. Right, like you, yeah. It's yeah, it's that's and, that's what happens. And what he also killed was Tom Donovan, right?
Yeah, Tom dies like, that day. Yeah,
as soon as Tom admit, I mean, we're skipping right ahead to the ending, but as soon as Tom admits, like, this is what happened. I shot Liberty Valance. Like, you don't need, you're not culpable or anything like that. At that point, he actually accepts it as like, I shot Liberty Valance, and I'm going to use this as something that will propel me throughout my career because I don't actually have the blood on my hands.
Yeah,
right. Like the it's ink on my hands. It's a story, right? I don't have blood on my hands. Tom has the blood on his hands, but in doing that and accepting that, Tom literally destroys himself.
Yep,
literally burns down his house, burns down the addition that he's building for Hallie, who's the love of his life. Tries to burn himself, tries to burn everything. And this whole story is framed by this flashback of like Senator Stoddard and his wife, those Jimmy Stewart and Vera Mile. They're revisiting this little frontier town called Shinbone. And it's to bury Tom, who he runs into these newspaper men who are shocked to see him. Oh my God, what's the senator doing in our little frontier town? They don't know his whole history in Shinbone. Again, like from the first, you know, few minutes, already legend has obscured origins, right? His legend is bigger than the truth already. But he's just visiting this town to bury Tom. They have no fucking idea who Tom is. They don't know that what Tom did
yeah.
in building the town, building the West, stopping Liberty Valance, who was the terror, who was preventing society from happening, preventing people from going to school, trying to prevent people from voting, trying to prevent just, you know, basic democracy
from
happening. From living when he murdered them, or from like using their arms and legs when he maimed them, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's, that's the whole flashback to this. But like I said, they don't even know who Tom was, but when we flash back, Tom is like, he's the hot shit of the town, but he's so like kind of cool. He doesn't really care about being the hot shit, and he doesn't want to like humiliate people or anything.
Oh,
you know, he's
not I disagree with that.
Well, he doesn't mind humiliating Rance.
He'll bully
That's
people.
For darn sure.
He is sure. Tom Swagger Donovan, and he's yeah. going to bully people. He's not going to be like Liberty and beat
no.
you.
No, no, no.
But he's going to get his way regardless. He's going to take your chair. He's going to push you around. He's going to tell you what to do.
No, absolutely. I think, again, he's fine with bullying Rance because Rance is competition. And he knows that, like, right away. Like, Hallie is interested in Rance. She may not be attracted to Rance. He's not as sexy as Tom. He's not as cool as Tom or as manly as Tom. But he represents something. He represents, like, frontiers, like new frontiers for people who are on the frontier, like frontiers into your mind and into your soul and into all sorts of other things. I think Tom is more defined by, like, inaction, you know, like he doesn't really do anything until it's kind of in his lap.
Yeah.
Again, he really just wants his house and his buddy Pompey.
Come and go as he pleases with the cattle.
And he wants to move it. Yeah, exactly. Do his cattle and have Hallie. And he's building the addition onto his house. This very symbolic addition of the house. Like, it's one of the most symbolic, like, you know, redecorating projects in, like, movie history. I mean, it's, like, really fantastic. And that's what he burns down, you know, when he at the end there.
And at the end, I think Pompey says he didn't really carry his gun anymore. It's like,
no,
that was the end of Tom Donovan. That the
it was, yeah, and like I said, no one knows him even as, like, oh yeah, he was the town drunk or whatever.
Yeah,
like, it just seems as though, like, he just withdrew into nothing. And Pompey seems like he kind of did. Pompey, like, aged a lot over the years too.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it's just like living with someone like that and loving someone like that and watching them, you know, destroy themselves and just, like, withdraw from society. I'm sure it was brutal for him. But this movie is, again, like, boy, as you said, Stewart is so good. My God. Wayne is so good. Vera Miles is so good. But, like, God damn it. Everyone is so good.
Everyone, Martin Lee, Marvin.
Every single part is perfectly cast and perfectly executed. The smallest parts have personality, inner life. They are relatable yet funny and or scary or disturbing or whatever they are, right? Like, you have the family who runs the cafe, John Quaylen, who is in so many John Ford movies, is, like, always the Yumpin' Yimini. He always plays the Swedish immigrant. He plays one in The Searchers and so many other John Ford movies. The newspaper editor, Edmund O'Brien, the raging drunk. He's a crusading raging drunk.
Speaks very flowery.
As you said, Strother Martin, who is just, like, constantly giggling.
He looks like
really
a deranged Rob
sort of
Schneider.
Way.
Or just Rob Schneider. Lee Van Cleef silently just staring down everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's a murderer's row.
And then you have
John Carradine comes in at the end.
The mayor of the town, who I Wimpy has more self-respect than this guy.
Andy Devine, yes, the sheriff of the town.
Cowardly lion of the town.
He's fantastic, yeah. Andy Devine's another John Ford regular.
But yeah, it's John Carradine at the end, just, like, visible vodka sweats coming off him.
He's really good.
Delivers, I mean, he's just, like, going to the rafters. Every line.
It's really good.
Every syllable. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Really, really
the,
good.
And I'm glad you brought up the humor, because there's so, like we said, the mayor is a chicken shit. That's funny. It's played for laughs. It's meant to be funny. But there's so much little bits in here that are cast-offs. The guy conducting the Democratic convention at the end, the way he's up on the podium, you know, or the lecterns, banging the gavel and calling who gets to talk next.
Mm-hmm.
This guy just sells it. He's almost rapping, because he's speaking in verse and rhyme and bigging people up to talk. There's so much humor of that sort, of when Vera Miles gets mad at people, especially, you know, in the kitchen area, throwing that big Andy Devine around. It's so good.
It's fantastic.
Good.
Yeah. The scene in the school is another one that hits on, like, all of the emotional parts of this movie, right? Because it's really funny. It's also really tender, and it makes you think about, like, education and what that means for people who are just coming to this country, and for their children especially, and how empowering it is. And then it's also really scary, because school gets canceled because Liberty Valance is coming to town. That means no more school. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of threat that he is. He's an existential threat. I mean, he's a threat to life and limb and property for sure, but he's also just a threat to the American way of life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the freedoms that were supposedly guaranteed in our Constitution.
There's so much we could talk
about.
Down
to like,
in this. Yeah. And that's like from one scene, a schoolhouse, in a schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. That's from one
exactly.
scene. And you, there, it feeds into so much of the layers of this film. Like the way they interact with Pompey, and when I say they, I mean Tom and Rance. They both have their different ways of interacting with Pompey. The one black character works for Tom Donovan. And you can tell that they both stick up for Pompey. You see it in their own different way. Rance saying he has a right to be in this school to learn, just like everybody, and he wants him to be there to learn to read. But he's not, doesn't quite treat him like an equal. He treats him as if, of course, the theory is that we're all equal.
Exactly.
But he doesn't treat him
like a citizen. Exactly. He treats him like a citizen.
Yeah.
Tom defends him as more of like a man.
Yeah. But Tom, you could tell, Tom would be the one who would say, well, we're not equal. But if I say he's got a right to be here, he's got a right to be here, you know? And
Right.
Who's going to kick him out?
I'm telling you.
So you have the two different views.
I don't need the law to tell me, for sure. Yeah, very, very, that's really astute. And it's all very subtle, too. Because again, like we're saying, John Ford's not a guy who's going to have, you know, make a speech and tell you, like, your underlying, here's what the movie's about, kind of. But I mean, you can figure it out if you're halfway intelligent, because he's such a great filmmaker. He's such a great storyteller. And what I think is, like, is for all of his skill as, like, a visual filmmaker, and we talked about that especially with My Darling Clementine, and there's so many other films you could just say,
well,
oh my god.
I think if you were to describe John Ford's oeuvre, like, you know, Vistas would be part of that. Like, people would say it's
absolutely.
Cinematic, like that, right? That's not this movie.
Not this movie. But I think he's also, what makes him even more Fordian to me is that he's so good at getting to the emotional heart or the meaning of every scene. Like, emotionally, you're right there. And again, he doesn't need to say it or anything like that. It's usually just done with simple framing, music, cinematography, and performance.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think of, to me, it does not get any simpler or any better, really, than this very early scene with Vera Miles and Andy Devine as the old sheriff. Okay, we haven't flashed back yet. She's just come back to the town. She gets into the wagon with the old sheriff, who's Andy Devine. And they have this kind of moment where she wants something without saying it.
Yeah.
He hears it without acknowledging it.
Yeah.
And this sort of mournful score, this really elegantly simple framing and photography, that does all the rest. And then the next scene, where are we? We're at Tom's burned down house so that she can get a cactus.
Yes.
Fire, right?
100%.
That's everything. Like, we don't need her to say, like, you know what? I've always still, you know, held a thing, you know, like, we don't need anyone to tell us anything. She doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything. All of the meaning is just right there without anything. And it's just in, like, how the facial expressions and where the score turns and how they're framed and how it comes out. It's just, it's so hard to describe it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To just say, like, that's just a great fucking storyteller who can, like, give you everything without necessarily giving you anything.
The economy of that filmmaking is so good, because he's going to be spare when he needs to be spare and let you feel it. That first 10 minutes, everybody in that place has capital T trauma that we are not discussing. It's just hanging all over all of us like a dark fucking blanket just on us. But he's going to be lively when the situation calls for that, whether we're in a saloon that's kicking off or I wanted to go to one of those Democratic rallies. Those were amazing.
Oh, right.
That just looked like a blast. But I see the influences.
Or the voting meeting.
Oh, just all of it.
The bar is closed, but you know, as soon as it's done, the bar is right open.
You see the influences on Spielberg. You see the influences on David Milch. You see the influences on like Wes Anderson. Like the way shots are composed, like three Mexican banditos walking past on the outside. And then we push in the saloon and the saloon is just going crazy. But there's enough like interesting figures occupying different space. Shit, even like Jacques Tati, enough interesting figures occupying different space that catches your eye. And it's this beautiful, delicate balance that looks, you would sit there and go, that's just, you know, cacophony, it's just raucous entertainment. But no, it's so composed and so well captured.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant filmmaking. So finally, we, of course, come to the end. We find out the truth, which is that we thought that the legend is that Rance shot Liberty Valance, finally stood up to him. I mean, basically just shot him point blank while Valance was drunk. Yeah. And
But I'm was about protecting to put one his life,
you know, to warned him, you know, and Valance was, you know, certainly his own threat and had already beaten the newspaperman half to death. But anyway, so that sort of starts the legend of Rance that kind of propels him to the senatorship. He finds out it was actually Tom who shot Liberty Valance, and Tom is going to keep the secret. And it's really interesting in that scene, Darcy pointed this out after we were watching it, is that the scene where we have a flashback within the flashback, right? Because we flashback to the murder of Liberty Valance. And after we come back and Rance realizes the truth, it's like within that scene, you can see in the frame, Rance just grows bigger and bigger. Tom, it just withers. He just like, he just shrinks in the frame. Rance just then comes in and he's, you know, greeted with applause as he accepts the nomination. Tom goes off and essentially self-immolates. Ben, and we find out, come back to the present, out of our nested flashbacks, and the newspaper men who have been hanging on their every word this entire time throw it all away. They just throw the notes away and they say, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. They're not going to be responsible for bringing down the career of the senator, which is what happened. Yeah. Because let's talk about how he's about to be up for the vice presidential nomination, most likely. His career has just taken him everywhere. He's been an ambassador. He's done all these sorts of things. And they're just not going to do it. And then, as you said, you had that scene where there's the cactus flower on the
casket
coffin, and they take the train back home, back to Washington, D.C., I believe. And, you know, again, kind of talking about like the production values of this, there's like a rear projection here. This, it doesn't look, you know, great necessarily, right? It's not like an epically beautiful scene on this train or anything like that. It's not a perfect shot or anything like that. It's perfectly framed and everything. But it's just a bit like, it's this train ride home where it's, this is what I talked about, the ambiguous note that it ends on. They both realize their lives have been a complete sham.
Yep.
He's a sham. Like, we know that. But we also know this woman has carried a fucking tiki torch for Tom. She has carried a flaming, like, kerosene rag-soaked torch for Tom her entire life. Tom sank into nothingness, just oblivion, as Rance just rose through the ranks and had this amazing life. All of it on the back of a lie and a murder. And it was all carried out for the good of America. So, boy, if they're a total sham, it's all a total sham, right? I mean, isn't that the implication of it? Without saying it. This is why I say, like, Ford isn't going to get on a soapbox, point a finger, and say, like, it's you. You know what I mean? Like, but that's the implication. Like, this punctures your soul in such a much more, like, profoundly subtle, like, surgically, like, manner of it. It's just like, what even fucking happened?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, I mean, this is just a fantastic, fantastic film. Corky.
Yes, sir.
You have a favorite scene, shot, performance, anything we didn't talk about that you want to bring up?
There's so much. And like I said, if this is one of those movies, I'm going to revisit this. This is another one where, as I said, I get to visit some of these movies that I've always heard about and confirm that they were great. Like Battleship Potemkin, another one. Always heard about it. Great movie. But this is one, it not only surprised me, I'm revisiting. I'm going to revisit this. Awesome. In the Mood for Love. I watched that like 3 times within a month of seeing it the first time. Just because I had to see it again.
This guy.
You know.
This fucking guy.
I'm going to watch it again. But since we just talked about it, that end scene, this is the brilliance of this kind of thing. Like you say, it's real simple, rear projection. That's that dialogue between the husband and the wife who are realizing, like, we've both been stuck in this past. What is this? What has all my accomplishment got me when it was ill-gotten? Like, he didn't need a second to digest the information from Tom. Like, he left that convention. He's ready to turn tail and run like he'd been threatening to do the entire movie. Tom says, it wasn't you. It was me. I killed him. Like, there is a vapor trail, and there's almost like a Bugs Bunny style hole through the door of Rance going back in.
No thought of, like, what does this mean for my old buddy?
Are you okay, Tom?
No. Yeah, like, wow, you just murdered a dude in cold blood.
I'm all about right and justice.
Nothing. Not a word. He just realizes, oh, awesome.
Oh, those law books I used to carry around with me? No. That's just resume shit now. And so they both realize this. And where does this scene happen? On a train. It's like the symbol of progress and innovation at that time. We're steaming forward ahead. Once the train came. We cannot go back. No matter how bad we want to, we can't change that shit. We're going this way, baby. I fucking love
it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they mentioned, like, you know, they come back to Shinbone at first and they're like, wow, I hardly recognize the place. And they say it's when the railroad came is when the town absolutely blew up. When we see Rance come to town at the beginning of the flashback, he's coming in a stagecoach.
Yeah.
And so he's very vulnerable to a bandit like Liberty Valance and his gang, because stagecoaches are a lot easier to hold up than a fucking train. You know what I mean? Like, so it's that kind of progress. And again, without spotlighting it, underlining it, talking about it or anything else, just letting it happen in the story and letting you as an audience member feel smart for getting it. I mean, that to me is like classic filmmaking. You know what I mean? It's like,
tells you enough that it wants to tell you, but lets you make some decisions.
Let you get all the rest of the connections there. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think there's anything to the names? Like Liberty, like the death of Liberty, him being named Ransom? I don't know. I couldn't find anything.
Ransom. Yeah, the Ransom thing was interesting. Yeah.
And then Tom.
His Rance.
Tom.
Tom. Tom. Tom Donovan. Tom Donovan. Donovan. So an Irish name.
Yeah, or he Rance just sings about Atlantis.
Stoddard. He just stopped.
Imagine John Wayne doing Sunshine Superman.
Right.
We've said this before. We said it before when we reviewed a very different John Wayne film about him as Genghis Khan. The man can ride a fucking horse. He's in his 50s, but he is in full command of every horse.
Very
around.
True. Very, very true. Yes, he is an old salt, that's for sure. Yeah. All right, let's wrap this up and give our ratings. Just to remind everybody, you know, we're just going to go through the motions here, make it official.
Sure.
We, of course, rate on the slider sound scale. If we both think that it was a sound selection, kaboom, cannons were. Into the cannon fodder, cannon it goes. If one or both of us think it was a little slight, no cannon for you. We'll put blah, 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 blah in its place. Blah, 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 blah. Quirky.
Yeah.
Mana shot, Liberty Valance, slider sound.
I'm loading up my hand cannon and kaboom, woo! Kaboom, kaboom. This is one of the best movies we've watched. One of the best movies, I think, that has been made. Do yourself a fucking favor. Watch this movie.
Good call by you. That's two sounds, and that means the cannon just had another baby.
Mm. Jesus.
Congratulations, cannon baby.
All right, that's what we thought about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. What did you think about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before?
We'd love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dear Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
All right. Now it's that time of the show where we randomly select the film that we're going to review in 2 weeks on our next episode. Corky, you ready to do this?
Let's go, baby.
Generate a random number. I command you. A random number has been generated. The number corresponds to a numbered list. And on that numbered list, Quirky, I have for you the Battle of Algiers.
Hey, I've heard a lot about this.
The Battle of Algiers is a 1966 film. It is directed by Gio Pontecorvo. Stars Brahim Hajjaj, Jean Martin, and Yosef Saadi. Read you the IMDb synopsis. In the 1950s, fear and violence escalate as the people of Algiers fight for independence from the French government. Quirky, sounds like this will be your first viewing of the Battle of Algiers. I have seen the film. It has been a while. It's probably a good 20, 25 or so years ago. I really liked it last time I saw it. Excited to see it. Again, I know it was a really big film amongst revolutionaries in the 1960s, but I don't really care about that. I care about its cinephile bona fides. And as far as I'm concerned, they are toit. So why don't you join us in 2 weeks, and we will talk about Battle of Algiers. Daniel, you interject. How do I watch Battle of Algiers? Well, good question. You can watch it if you subscribe to the Criterion channel or HBO Max. It is also available for free to watch on Canopy. That's Canopy with a K. If you have a library card and your library uses Canopy, Canopy is awesome. You can watch it free, ad-supported, on Tubi, or it's available for rent on all your usual VOD services. It is 121 minutes long. 2 weeks. Come back here. Battle of Algiers. Fight it out.
Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit DareDaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to my man Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I am said Daniel Barnes. And until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.